Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Gastroesophageal Cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Manish Shah from the Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding program featuring Dr. Shah's slide presentation. In his talk, he commented on recent press releases announcing that there are two phase 3 trials of first-line therapy with the addition of the anti-claudin antibody zolbetuximab to chemotherapy that reportedly have met their primary endpoints and will be presented in an upcoming scientific meeting soon. To begin my discussion with Dr. Shah, I asked him for his early thoughts on this exciting development.
I think there are two issues with the use of zolbetuximab in the first-line setting. I mean, so first of all, it's great to have a positive study and another target in upper GI cancers. And I think it'll be important to look at the magnitude of benefit, both for progression and overall survival, and weigh that against the toxicity. We mentioned with the FAST study that an on-target side effect is actually nausea and vomiting. And I think these toxicities are not new toxicities for medical oncologists. We've been dealing with nausea and vomiting since the advent of cisplatin. But I think we want to be able to make sure we manage that well in this context in the first-line setting so that we can keep the benefit of survival with the manageable toxicity profile. I think that's the key message. And then the other thing that we need to look at for is actually which patients would actually benefit. Both the GLOW and the SPOTLIGHT studies were limited to patients with greater than 75% expression of claudin 18.2. So it would be good to know which patients are they. Are those patients also HER2 positive? Are they also CPS positive? Because for those other populations, we have other targeted agents as well. So how to integrate claudin 18.2 in the context of the other targets that we have is an important aspect as well.
So about what fraction of patients do have greater than 75%?
About a third.
About a third. And for those patients right now, or your patients with metastatic gastric or gastroesophageal cancer, what is your current non-protocol approach, and to what extent, if any, do you integrate checkpoint inhibitors?
My current non-protocol approach is if you're CPS 5 or higher, I would include nivolumab for gastric and GE junction tumors. For esophageal squamous cell cancer, I consider pembrolizumab with chemotherapy for CPS 10 or higher. And even for adenocarcinoma for distal esophageal cancers, I do use pembrolizumab for CPS 10 or higher. And then if you're HER2 positive, I incorporate trastuzumab in the first line setting. I think those are the key things. If you're mismatch repair deficient, at least at this point, immunotherapy is really in the second line setting only if you didn't use it in the first line setting. So most patients who are mismatch repair deficient will have a high CPS and will be using immunotherapy in the first line setting anyway. But I think that's my current approach. But I think that there's a lot of opportunity for kind of the nuances of when to use what. I mean, certainly if you're HER2 positive, trastuzumab plus pembro, now that it's approved, plus chemo is actually, I didn't mention that earlier, but that's actually what I would do for that population.
So we'll get into that in a second with your HER2 case, but what are you going to do with somebody who, assuming the claudin data is impressive, based on the randomized phase 2, that looked pretty good too, although we've been disappointed before. But what are you going to do with somebody who's got claudin and high CPS?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think I need to see the data. I think we all need to see the data and look at it more carefully. The high CPS patients definitely benefit from nivolumab. And I think for all of these therapies, it's more than the median. It's actually the tail on the curve. If you have a 30%, 2-year, 3-year survival, for gastric cancer, I think people would go for that, even if you had some more nausea, vomiting. So, I think we need to look at the curves and look at them very carefully to see, is there a durable benefit with zolbetuximab as there seems to be with nivolumab in some patients or pembrolizumab. So I think that the details of the curves, the details of the toxicity will matter.
You know, also it kind of gets into sort of the splitter versus lumper thing in terms of PD-1. And we see this in a variety of tumors as comes up when you have a trial that has this overall endpoint that it meets, but then you see subset analyses and you see subsets that don't seem to benefit. And
right.
I know there's a lot of controversy about that, but and you know, from what we can tell when we ask people, people either buy into it or they don't buy into it. But it sounds like you're a believer in looking at PD-1 and not giving it to people whose PD-1 is below what's been proven in the trials. Another way to look at it would be, and I don't know whether in those patients you end up giving them IO when they run out of treatment options, because that's sort of the other issue, is I think people have this general idea that there's some possibility of, if not a home run, significant response with an IO, even in PD-1 low patients, and you have people who've run out of options. So how are you thinking about, are you thinking you're not going to use IOs in general in these people, or are you going to use it later?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, and part of it is philosophical. The government passed the law that says that patients should get access to a Hail Mary drug. And I'm not saying that a PD-1 inhibitor for CPS2 is a Hail Mary. You know, we used to do it with pembrolizumab in the third line setting, like all the time until ODAC, lifted that approval. And there are some patients that benefit. I mean, I think that we really need to spend some time thinking about which of the patients that benefit. I guess the underlying philosophy really is that with the number of drugs that we have, if we can identify the right drug for the right patient, we can give the patient the best benefit. And if, I think that's what most of us are all about. We want to give patients the most benefit possible. So instead of throwing the kitchen sink at somebody, we want to throw a spoon for a bowl of soup, meaning that we want the right drug for the right patient. And the right patient is the one that has the target that will be responsive. So there are some patients who have a high CPS that don't benefit from immunotherapy. So we need to do some research to understand why that is. Right now, we don't have that data, so we give everybody that. And there are some patients who don't benefit. Most patients with a low CPS won't benefit. We agree with that. But, until we know why, there will be always a few patients that say, well, let's just try because what do I have to lose? I think the research needs to be, let's try to figure out who's benefiting and why and who's not benefiting and why, so we can figure that, figure out the right, we can thread the needle the right way. I think that's really where we need to be in terms of research for GI cancers. So some of the things that we also need to talk about are actually, a lot of the work that's been done up to date is actually trying to target alterations within the cancer cell. So if you have a overexpression of a protein or you have a mutation in a gene, you target that. But we haven't spent a lot of time targeting the microenvironment, which is really, really critical. I mean, to a certain extent, PD-1 inhibition is the microenvironment. We're modifying the microenvironment to activate T cells. But that's just one drug and one strategy. The microenvironment is probably more complex than the cancer cell. So if we could figure out the right microenvironment for where drugs will work, I think that'll open up more doors as well. So, I think it's a great question. I think that, everybody, if they're well enough, should have a chance. But I think that we need to spend more time understanding which patients will benefit from what drugs to use its more, use the treatments, in a smarter way.
And I guess until we get a better idea, we can always involve the patient in these difficult decisions where it kind of looks like they're not going to benefit, but at least we can get them involved. Let me ask you, I could imagine, I can't really think of a situation where an antibody causes nausea and vomiting directly, but since you mentioned that it's an on-target effect, Do you want to have your patient feeling like a little queasy? Does that make you feel better that you're, you know, it's hitting the target?
Yeah, no, that's a good, I don't think, we don't have data that the more nauseous you felt, the more benefit there is. I think that what I meant by on target effect is that the protein claudin 18.2 is expressed on the cancer cell, but also right. on the normal gastric epithelium. So right. you kind of expect, that, you know, if the drug is, you know, is doing anything, it's going to cause some nausea because it, you know, the receptors are there. So that's what I meant by, you know, kind of an on target effect. But I think it's an important point. Like, you know, how we manage the nausea, how we, you know, kind of control that will be a key aspect of how well we can use zolbetuximab, or any of the claudin 18.2, you know, new targets that are being developed.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't know if I was flashing on, there's a TKI in bladder cancer. Well, not just bladder, beyond that, FGFR1, I think cholangio also, where you see hyperphosphatemia. And I've heard people say they like to see a little bit of it because it tells them the drugs work. And that's, I was kind of thinking about that here. Right. You mentioned CAR T, and of course, all the oncologists are waiting for CAR T to come to solid tumors. It seems like it's never going to happen. What's your take on that? You know, one of the things that you see with the hematologic cancers in CAR T is like you have the diffuse large B cell model where it looks like it's curing some people, just like upfront or CHOP does. And yet with myeloma, it looks like it's not curing anybody, like kind of what happens with myeloma. Any thoughts about what's going to happen here? It's amazing that they just even saw responses, I think is really cool. But any thoughts about whether or not maybe there's going to be some kind of tail on the curve, maybe the possibility of cure here, or is this going to be another palliative therapy?
Yeah, I think that's $1 million question, maybe $1 billion question, as expensive CAR Ts are. But I think that if not this CAR T, another CAR T will be developed that will be practice changing for some patients with gastroesophageal cancer. I think that there will be CAR T therapy that will have a durable, prolonged benefit and maybe even a cure. It's just an exciting time to be able to harness the powers of the immune system against cancer. And, you know, in many ways, the success in lymphoma, is paving the way. Like it, because it's possible, it means that there is a path forward. We just have to figure out the right path. So the main, you know, difference in, you know, solid tumors versus lymphoma is the microenvironment. And if we can understand that and overcome that, we will be able to, make CAR Ts more durable and maybe durable enough that we even, you know, say the C word, the cure word.
Yeah. So, speaking about learning from, you know, hematologic cancers, we just had a couple weeks ago, the first bispecific approved in myeloma. There's a bispecific in lung cancer, amivantanib. Any thoughts about bispecifics in gastroesophageal cancer?
Yeah, I think the same thing. There are some in development. There's a bispecific targeting CEA and CD3. So you use the antibody to get to, you know, to CEA expressing solid tumors, and then you bring the T cells into that space. So, you know, and there is some activity, at least in the early stage. So, you know, I think that's one strategy that could work as well. I think that, you know, so far, all the therapies that we've talked about right now, CAR T and then even the bispecifics, are really bringing in T cells. But I think that the complexity of the microenvironment is way more than that, right? There are NK cells and macrophages, and these can be M2 or M1. So we need to kind of understand that better to understand, you know, if there are other ways to target that. And I shouldn't say that we haven't. I mean, you know, CSF1R is a target on macrophages. And, you know, there are many companies that have drugs that are targeting that to try to overcome the resistance caused by these macrophages. So I think that as, you know, the amount of progress we've made in the last 15 years targeting the tumor itself is, I think, you know, a fraction of the amount yet to come targeting the microenvironment.
Are you familiar with the, I guess, the one case that was published in the New England Journal of Pancreatic Cancer with this sort of CAR T-like product. I don't even understand exactly what it is. What is that? And do you see a future for that in solid tumors?
Yeah, so that's the work of Dr. Rosenberg at the NIH, and it's really, really quite remarkable. He's really a visionary, forward-looking guy. So the way I understand it is that he takes a patient's T cells and he educates them against the tumor antigen, and then he's able to, expand these T cells and then give them back to the patient. So by doing that, you basically are giving them educated T cells against the patient's tumor. And the New England Journal paper, was, a proof of concept about that. I think that he has other evidence of that kind of strategy working, but I think it's, and the way I explained it is actually very rudimentary. It's very exciting work that's being done.
All right, let's talk about your cases. What happened with your 65-year-old man here?
Yeah, so this is a 65-year-old gentleman who presented with fatigue, abdominal pain, worsening with eating, and unintentional weight loss. His past medical history is notable for osteoarthritis, hypertension. He's a pre-diabetic. His exam is unremarkable. His performance status is 1. His labs show a hemoglobin of 12, white count of 10, slightly elevated, bilirubin 0.4, normal creatinine. LFTs and ALKs are within normal limits, and the CA19-9 is slightly elevated at 43. An endoscopy is done, and it shows a 4.3 centimeter mass at the GE junction. A CAT scan, unfortunately, showed multiple liver metastases, intra-abdominal lymph node metastases as well, and the biopsy of the liver showed adenocarcinoma. So, one of the questions that we'd like to ask is, what are the biomarkers that we consider to prioritize, what to do for this patient? This is a patient, first line, newly diagnosed, no real medical comorbidities. And, we just talked about all the ones that we need to test for. We need to test for HER2. We need to test for PD-L1 expression by the combined positive score. We need to know the MSI high status. And pretty soon, we'll probably need to know claudin 18.2 status to get a full picture of what's going on here. TMB, so we didn't talk about that, but pembrolizumab is approved for high TMB tumors. So I think there's an argument to do that. That requires some next generation sequencing. The key thing is having enough tissue for all these biomarkers, and that's another area that will be an issue for many people. Although EBV is an important factor in developing gastric cancer, it's one of the 4 subtypes of gastric cancer, according to the TCGA. But right now, that's not an important biomarker for determining treatment. So in our case, the patient was actually HER2 IHC3 plus, PD-L1 positive, microsatellite stable. We treated the patient with pembrolizumab and trastuzumab and FOLFOX, cisplatin 5-FU chemotherapy. And the patient, did actually very well with a good response. But there were treatment-related complications, infections, neutropenia, hand-foot syndrome. And so after about 4 months, the patient was continued on maintenance trastuzumab and pembrolizumab.
Do you happen to remember what his PD-1 level was? You said it was positive.
Oh, it was 10, yeah.
10. So I guess one question I just want to throw in here before you continue, because, everybody kind of jumped on this bandwagon with the Pembro. But to me, one of the things I noticed in that, fairly small study that got it approved was that 85% of the people in the study were PD-1 positive. So you couldn't really make a comment about whether it's really, getting back to your issue, do you see any benefit if it's PD-1 low?
Right.
So just out of curiosity, if you had the same exact patient with PD-1 of 0, would you still have given the Pembro?
Yeah, that's a great question. It would be great to get more data on that. Like, what's the actual response rate in HER2 positive PD-L1 low patients? It wasn't a requirement because the standard of care was actually giving trastuzumab for HER2 positive patients. So they didn't actually check, at least prospectively, the PD-L1 status. Based on the science that I understand, the physiology I understand, I think that having trastuzumab bind to the HER2 receptor is in and of itself a activating immune signature that then Pembro can add to. So I'm not sure, and I wouldn't predict that the PD-L1 status makes that much of a difference in this combination. I think that activating the immune system is the key aspect there.
Yeah, that's really a great point. So let's get to the real question here, which is what do you do when the patient relapses, which I guess happens 6 months later with this man. So what about your first question here? Do you biopsy? Do you do HER2 again? And do you approach it differently if it's now HER2 negative? How do you generally think that through?
We know from prior studies, like particularly the Gatsby study, which was a negative study in the second line setting for gastric cancer, that one of the reasons why it may have been negative is because as many as 20% of patients may have lost their HER2 signal. So then if you're giving a HER2 targeted agent and there's no HER2 around, then you may not be benefiting the patient. And I think in my talk, I highlighted this, but not probably enough. Unlike breast cancer, where HER2 positive breast cancer is a clonal thing, if you're HER2 positive in breast cancer, all the cancer cells are HER2 positive. In gastric and esophageal cancer, it's subclonal, meaning that you have a population that's HER2 positive, but you have a population that's not HER2 positive. So therefore, continuing trastuzumab beyond progression is negative in gastric cancer because, in the first line setting, you might have killed all the HER2 positive cells and there may not be any HER2 positive cells remaining that where targeting HER2, continuing inhibition of HER2, it makes any difference. So we do biopsy. To answer the question for this patient here, we would like to biopsy to ensure that there is still a HER2 signaling. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is a great drug, but it's not like trastuzumab where you can give it with very little side effects or toxicity. There is some chemotherapy related side effects like fatigue and weakness and nausea and things like that. So particularly when you have that side effect profile, you don't want to just give the drug unless you know that there is still a HER2 signal.
And of course, and I'm going to ask you about this, there's also the issue of interstitial lung disease. But let's just focus right now before we get to that on the decision about second line therapy. Because incidentally, one of the things that is very, always interesting to me is, use your idea about heterogeneity compared to breast cancer. Although I think you see a certain amount of heterogeneity in breast cancer. But the bottom line is, in breast cancer, if you start out HER2 positive in breast cancer, you're HER2 positive for life. It doesn't matter if you come back IUCs afterwards, the breast cancer docs are going to keep using HER2 therapy. Whereas what I see with the GI people is exactly what you're describing, trying to be more specific about whether it's still there. Of course, now that you have T-DXd in the mix, you have the question of whether it works in HER2 low. Of course, that is exploding in breast cancer. Do we have much data on that question, incidentally, in upper GI cancer?
Yeah, so the gastric O2 study, there was a colon cancer cohort as well. It was actually Destiny colon cancer. And there they looked at HER2 low as well. And the response rates were not as significant. So, I think the feeling is that just like HER2 is a subclonal disease for the heterogeneity in gastric cancer, for that same reason, trastuzumab deruxtecan may have not as much activity in HER2 low as it does in breast cancer. But I think it hasn't been fully studied. I think we need to get more data in that space specifically. And it could be that, trastuzumab deruxtecan plus immunotherapy might be quite effective in HER2 low. We just don't know.
So kind of getting back to your patient and practical issues about making the decision, which I think from what I hear, the first two options you have there, ribociramab, paclitaxel, and T-DXd, seem to be the more common things that are considered. And of course, one of the big issues that hangs over that decision is interstitial lung disease. You know, obviously we have a lot more data on that in breast cancer, but the story in breast cancer is it definitely occurs. It can occur way after the treat, you know, later on in the treatment. It can be fatal. You know, whole idea of trying to pick people up before they're symptomatic, if possible. What do we know about interstitial lung disease and TDXD and upper GI cancers?
Yeah, it's actually very similar. So, you know, in the initial trastuzumab deruxtecan studies, it was actually included both breast and gastric and other solid tumors. And the rate of interstitial lung disease was the same across the board. So it is a significant issue in gastric cancer as well. The other thing that came up is that with early identification of the initial symptoms of interstitial lung disease and acting on it, giving steroids, holding the drug, things like that, the grade 5 events, you know, the events that kill people are much less likely. So, you know, I think, you know, one of the challenges with TDXD is educating both patients and physicians who are using it that this is an important thing that can be life-threatening. You have to identify it early and act on it early. And if you do that, you can give the drug safely.
And of course, there's a huge debate about this issue in lung cancer with HER2 mutant disease. But there, you have a lot of people already have pulmonary problems, which makes it even more complicated. You have a younger patient, 65 years old, I'm assuming nothing, no other, doesn't look like any major comorbidities or any pulmonary problems. So I'm really curious what you actually did with this patient. I guess I'm going to put my money on TDXD because the patient was younger, but you tell me.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, the patient was still IHC 2 plus and FISH positive. And so, right. Still positive, not 3 plus. And so, we did give trastuzumab deruxtecan. I think, but you make a very good point. I mean, both are good options and reasonable options. I think that, you know, the Taxol and ramucirumab is something that can be given in third line. It's safe. It's easy. The trastuzumab deruxtecan, you know, it can have side effects. So giving it earlier when people are more robust made a little more sense to me.
So what happened with the patient?
Yeah, the patient received TDXD and had a, you know, good response for about 6 months. And then ultimately did progress. The patient did get some shortness of breath. We, you know, held the TDXD. It turned out that with the bronchoscopy, it was probably COVID actually.
Wow.
And so, but we didn't actually re-challenge the patient. We, ended up going to, a few months of the ramucirumab and paclitaxel.
Wow. But so he actually got COVID?
The patient did get COVID. Yeah.
Wow.
This is a recent case, and, like 6 months ago.
And you initially you weren't sure whether it was the TDXD or you were pretty sure that it was COVID from the beginning.
So it's challenging. So the swab was positive for COVID. He was short of breath. And then you have to make a decision. If the patient's on TDXD and has COVID and there's pulmonary infiltrates, what do you do? And to a certain extent, the treatment is probably a similar, you know, steroids. But I think it was important for us to know because there are other COVID treatments like Paxlovid or antibodies or things like that. So we need to know how sick was the patient from the COVID versus TDXD. So that's why we ended up doing a bronch and trying to figure this out.
That's really interesting. Did he have a lot of other symptoms, you know, cough, shortness of breath, rhinorrhea, congestion, anything to sort of push you one way or the other? Fever?
He really had some congestion and shortness of breath. That was the main thing. He didn't have any change in taste. He didn't have any other kind of COVID-defining type symptoms. He lived in a multi, you know, person home and nobody else was sick. So we weren't sure 100% one way or the other.
Wow, that's an amazing case. When he got the TDXD, you know, one of the things we hear from people, as you were alluding to, is chemo-type side effects, nausea, vomiting, hair loss. Yeah. Did he have any of that?
Not the hair loss, nausea, vomiting, weakness. That was the main thing.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to your next case.
So this is a 75-year-old woman with a newly diagnosed gastric cancer. The patient had metastatic disease to the liver. A biopsy of the liver showed, confirm adenocarcinoma. The CPS was 10 here. It's HER2 IHC 0 and mismatch repair proficient. The patient started, because of the high CPS, FOLFOX and nivolumab, and did pretty well. As expected, had neuropathy after, more than 3 months of oxaliplatin, so we discontinued that. We ultimately stopped the 5-FU as well, and ultimately the patient was on nivolumab maintenance therapy and was on treatment for about 12 months before developing new lung lesions consistent with metastatic disease.
I was just sort of thinking, if the data from zolbetuximab lead to an approval, I wonder what you would do with a patient like this is in the second line situation. If they were Claudin positive, could you treat second line? I mean, I don't know what the indication might say, but theoretically anyhow.
So the ILLUSTRO trial is a study that is examining zolbetuximab with chemotherapy and also with immunotherapy across multiple lines of therapy. So it'd be good to look at that data to see, again, what the indication is. Sometimes the FDA will give indications beyond what the trial showed if the activity is so high. I think that we have proof of principle that targeting Claudin 18.2 is an effective strategy, but I don't think we have any data of zolbetuximab in the second line setting with a taxane, for example. And, I think, someone in the second line setting, I guess this is one of the questions that we kind of think about all the time. Of the people that start first line therapy, only about half are well enough to get second line therapy. And really by that, they need to have an adequate performance status. They need to be still pretty functional, things like that. Their labs have to be pretty good. Gastric cancer, particularly with high burden of disease, is tough. It can cause, just from the disease burden, people can lose a lot of weight, become malnourished. They can have peritoneal disease and carcinomatosis, that kind of thing. And so for that reason, I counsel people to really act early. If you see your patient declining, don't wait 2 months to get a CAT scan. Get a CAT scan at 6 weeks and see if the patient's progressing. Because if you wait too long, you may miss the opportunity to get more treatment. And one of the things that we're, observing is that we're leaving treatments, on the shelf. In gastric cancer, we have FOLFOX, we have FOLFIRI, we have, paclitaxel, ramucirumab, we have pembrolizumab or nivolumab. We may have zolbetuximab. We have trifluridine tipiracil. Yeah, TAS-102. So we have all these drugs that are available. And the majority of people with gastric cancer won't receive all those drugs. And I think that we know from colon cancer, the more drugs you receive, the better your outcome is. And it, of course, is that because you were able to receive more drugs or is that because you were able to strategically go from one line to the next line quickly. And I think that's what we need to get to. So, I think to answer your question, I wouldn't know what to do with zolbetuximab unless we kind of had some safety data with a taxane or something like that in the second line setting. But I think that, that may play a role in what you choose first. If zolbetuximab is first line and you're able to get immunotherapy in the second line, maybe you do zolbetuximab first and immunotherapy second. But I think the key message is really to try to kind of anticipate if your patient is declining and act early, particularly for gastroesophageal cancers, is really critical.
That's a great point. I'm starting to hear people talk more about circulating DNA as a way to monitor disease. I mean, outside of like where I've heard about it being used, I hear people using it like a tumor marker. In what situations do you find it helpful?
Yeah, I think that the strongest data for upper GI cancers are in the space of minimal residual disease. And that is where the patient has had surgery and should be NED. In that population, if you're positive, your ctDNA is positive, it's a bad predictor. You're almost certainly going to have recurrence. And if your ctDNA is negative, your chance of not having recurrence is much higher. So a lot of the studies that we're planning in upper GI cancers are in that space where your ctDNA is positive. Can you act on that and treat that? But you're right. Like, as we have more data, if your ctDNA quantification is rising, is that indicator that your tumor bulk is increasing and that you need to change therapy? That may actually help us give people more treatments, as we're talking about, as instead of waiting until there's obvious progression on a CAT scan, and then they may not be well enough for more treatment.
Yeah, actually, just a couple hours ago, I did a session like this with Joyce O'Shaughnessy on breast cancer, and she was talking about a study in metastatic disease where they looked at people whose ctDNA went up, and they treated them before they had, changes on imaging, et cetera. And they saw benefits. So I don't know if we're moving in that direction in general in oncology.
Yeah, I think we are. We just need to have more data, but I think that it just makes sense.
So what's the follow-up on this patient? I was going to ask you also, you put out there a paclitaxel or FOLFIRI with ramucirumab. Do you ever use ramucirumab alone?
I have. So ramucirumab alone is as effective as most of the chemotherapies that are used alone as a single agent. Certainly in someone who may not be well enough for cytotoxic therapy or someone with limited disease, I think ramucirumab alone is a good option.
All right. So what happened with the patient?
Yeah. So, this patient progressed, after about 12 months. She's 75. She had some neuropathy, but she was still very functional. So, certainly she was HER2 negative. So there's no need to re-biopsy the patient to see if she becomes HER2 positive. If you're negative, you're negative. So she did receive second line therapy. Because of the neuropathy, we gave her FOLFIRI, plus ramucirumab, and that's approved. And she did pretty well for a while, but we dropped the chemotherapy after 3 months and just continued ramucirumab. And then after 3 months of that, we ended up stopping all therapy. And unfortunately, she wasn't well enough for third line therapy. So, this is a case in point that if we can get through two lines, that's great. And we hope for three lines of therapy.
All right, let's go to your last case, the 56-year-old patient.
Yeah, so this is an important case we haven't really talked about much, which is locally advanced disease. So this is a patient with a locally advanced gastric cancer, presented with dysphagia, some weight loss, and the workup revealed a T3N1 tumor that was done by EUS and CAT scan and laparoscopy. So in this setting, I think a key thing that we wanted to highlight is that the current standard of care is to use the FLOT regimen. That's a 24-hour treatment every other week. You do four cycles before and after surgery, and that gives you the best outcomes. So I think that's a key message here for a locally advanced patient. But I think what I wanted to highlight is then what happens all too often. And this is where we need to really do more research in upper GI cancers. Although FLOT is a standard of care, about a third of patients really don't benefit at all. And this patient, unfortunately, had really minimal evidence of response. At the time of resection, the tumor was a T4N3 with 13 positive lymph nodes. So it was really quite an extensive tumor. It was mismatch repair deficient, HER2 negative, CPS 20. And so after completing adjuvant therapy, unfortunately, the patient developed early recurrent disease with a metastatic disease in the liver. And I think that's where the discussion is, what's the next treatment at this point?
I guess the other question is, what would you have done or what should have been done up front if you knew the patient was MMR deficient? Would you have done the same thing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. So there are some phase two data that suggests that immunotherapy might be very effective in MMR deficient tumors. I think a definitive study is being planned through the intergroup. And also there's some data that suggests that chemotherapy, like perioperative therapy or chemoradiation for MMR deficient tumors is actually ineffective as it was in this case. So that would make the argument that maybe testing for MMR deficiency is very important even at the time of diagnosis, because, you know, currently the standard is either immunotherapy alone, or going straight to surgery and just removing the tumor. Those would be the best options. In this case, of course, with, you know, progression after FLOT, we would start with pembrolizumab for MMR deficient tumors.
And what's the follow-up with the patient?
Yeah, so mismatch repair deficiency, it's a great biomarker for immunotherapy. And this patient did really well and actually is just approaching 2 years of therapy.
Wow.
With immunotherapy, and it remains NED at that time. I guess the other question that comes up is, like, do you stop treatment? And, you know, I think most of our trials are to stop immunotherapy at 2 years, and that's what we've done in the past, and that's what will happen for this patient too. We'll stop treatment and kind of follow them. In my experience, about half the patients who we stop end up progressing, and we can re-challenge with immunotherapy, but about half the patients, they haven't required to go back on treatment. They've actually, you know, we're still following them, but they've done very well.
I'm hearing more about using neoadjuvant IO and MSI high. Of course, there was the rectal study with, you know, got all that attention. But I've been hearing that in upper GI as well. Just kind of curious, yeah. if you were, first of all, in metastatic upper GI cancer, let's say they no prior treatment and they're MSI high, are you going to use IO alone, chemo, both?
Yeah, so we don't have the first-line data that we do in colon cancer, the KEYNOTE-177 study that compared IO to chemotherapy. In that study, IO was way better, significantly better for the durable long-term responses. But in the first 6 months, chemotherapy seemed to do better. And I fear that in upper GI cancers, it's the same kind of thing, that there are some patients who, if you don't have a response to therapy, you're not going to get second-line treatment. So in that setting, you know, I think we need to figure out the right strategy. My bias is, if you have a high burden of disease or if you really need a response, I'm going to do chemo plus IO and then drop the chemo very quickly and continue IO. But we don't have the data to know what the right thing to do is yet.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. What about a patient like this who, let's say, gets neoadjuvant IO alone? And on clinically and on imaging, it looks like they have a CR. Any way you would consider not going to surgery, or maybe if the patient were older?
I have a patient just like this. A patient's in their 80s with Lynch syndrome. And he had locally advanced gastric cancer, kind of borderline resectable. We started IO therapy. We're now in month 18. The endoscopy shows no cancer, and we're not going to surgery unless we have to.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Shah, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.